Hey guys, what's up? I'm Sarah, and welcome back to Unwholesome Content.
Maybe a Ted Bundy who has that vulnerability.
It's when the cannibalism started. Eating of the heart.
Said that the Hawkins girl's head was severed. Unwholesome Content.
Hey guys, I'm Sarah. If this is your first time listening, today we are going to talk about a case that just makes me cringe, and I'm sure it's going to make you cringe as well. The case that we're talking about today is Susan Smith and her two sweet innocent babies. So trigger warning for this episode, it does involve child death, so just be prepared. If you don't want to listen to that, then I recommend not listening to this. I'll try to say trigger warning before I say some pretty gnarly stuff and stuff that's really bad. But yeah, just be prepared. Yeah, also be prepared to be angry, because if you hadn't heard about this case before, I promise you, you're going to want to throw your phone. But also don't, because you won't be able to listen to me. But anyway, just be prepared for this shit show of a case. I haven't decided if we're going to do a part one, part two yet. I thought I would just start and see if it's going to take that long. There's a lot of information in this case. Like, it's just a shit show. So there possibly will be a part two. I'm not sure yet, but you guys will know by the time you're listening to this. So let's just jump right in, right? Susan Vaughn Smith, she was born on September 26, 1971. Wait, does that make her a Sagittarius? I can't remember. It's September or November that a Sagittarius. Yeah, I said Sagittarius, I know. But I don't know. I'm pretty sure it is. I can't remember. Somebody let me know. I'll probably Google it after this, but I don't know if she's a Sagittarius or what's the other one that comes before that. I'm not sure. I'm here talking to myself about fucking zodiac signs, and I need to get into this. So Susan grew up and stayed living in Union County, South Carolina. This is where all of this shit takes place. She didn't move anywhere after she grew up. This is her town. This is where everything happens. She has two brothers. Susan did have a rough childhood and rarely any kind of stability growing up. When she was just 6 years old, her parents divorced, and her biological dad went ahead and committed suicide. This resulted in Susan becoming a distant and sad child. Within weeks of the suicide and divorce, her mother, Linda, remarried a local businessman named Bev Russell. From there, Linda took her kids and moved from their small, modest home into a more extravagant house with Bev, her new husband. So they basically moved across town into, like, the richer area of Union. So when Susan reached high school, she was described as well-liked and all-around a good person. I do think she won, like, the most friendliest person in high school, I'm pretty sure, in the yearbook. I'm pretty sure that's what I read. As happy as Susan seemed to be in public, it later came out that at the age of 16, her stepdad started molesting her. Susan went to her mother and social services, and Bev moved out. She obviously wanted help, or, you know, she tried to reach out to them, and Bev automatically just moved out. Her stepdad never was charged, so he was never charged with anything, and literally nothing was done at that point. So the result of this was that they went to a few family counseling sessions, and after that, he moved back in like nothing was wrong. Like, he just didn't do anything. Ugh, I hate her mom right now. Like, I can just imagine her mom, like, letting that be okay. Gross. I think I hate her even more because she was so concerned about people finding out about, like, her husband, the pedo, than her daughter's well-being and her what's happening to her daughter. Like, she's more concerned about what people think than what the hell's happening. Like, that's disgusting. Her mom was really upset that she went to social services and the embarrassment it caused her. So with Bev the pedo back in the house, the sexual abuse continued. When Susan was a senior in high school, she again sought out help. She went to the school counselor, who then went to social services again. This time, they urged Susan to press charges, but of course she refused, and really nothing became of it and all of those files became sealed because she was underage. So any like inquiry from law enforcement, anything like that, it became sealed because she was a minor. So jumping ahead a little bit, in the summer of 1988, Susan got a job at a grocery store. She went from cashier to bookkeeper pretty fast, and from her side of mind, she thought she was finally in a good place. She began acting out sexually, you can say. I mean, she's a teenager, and she's horny, I guess, so she began being wild. I mean, my personal opinion is that you could sleep whoever you want to fucking sleep. Like, if you know sex, and you know how to have safe sex, and you know all the stuff about sex, then go ahead and have sex, but as long as you know what you're doing, and as long as it's consensual and not cheating, anything like that, like, who cares? Let your freak flag fly, Susan. But Susan was sleeping with 3 men for a period of time. The first one was a married man who worked with her at the grocery store, a younger coworker, and she was also sleeping with her stepdad, Bev, still. Yikes. At this point, I don't know if it was consensual between her and her dad, like, if she was, like, wanting to do it, because information that later comes out, it seems like she was liking it and she continued doing it. I don't know if it was for the attention, if she really loved him, like, I don't know what was going on there, but obviously your stepdad was still sexually abusing her, and at that point she's still a teenager, so I don't think that should be held against her at that time, because he's been doing it for a long time. At what point does, what's that called, Stockholm syndrome come in? If when, like, your abuser, you fall in love with them and, like, you think they're a good person, you can't live without them. So I'm wondering if that was going on, because she was still a kid. Like, that's still sexual abuse. It's still Bev's fault for doing that shit. So during this time she was sleeping with these men, Susan became pregnant. Yep, this dumb bitch, I swear to God. She did end up having an abortion, and things began to crash down for her pretty fast. The married man that was sleeping with her ended their little affair, and she was heartbroken. I do believe that his married man's wife found out, and she came into the store with their children and was like, oh, are you working with your baby today or something like that? And Susan's like, oh, fuck. So, of course, the married man, you know, cut it off because that's his wife and his kids. So Susan was so heartbroken, and her reaction to the breakup, it was that she tried to commit suicide. She decided to take a lot of Tylenol and aspirin pills, but obviously she wasn't successful, and she was admitted to the hospital. While under psychiatric care, she confessed to attempting suicide when she was 13 years old as well. I'm assuming it's the same way of taking pills. So let's move it along the timeline here to when she's out of the hospital. Susan starts things up with a coworker named David. David was around the same age as her. It's David Smith, by the way. That's his last name, is Smith. So this is her future husband. David was around the same age as her, and they even went to the same high school together. David was actually engaged at the time to another woman. And, you know, little homewrecker Susan had to come in and wreck. So David ended his engagement with this other woman, and him and Susan started dating semi-seriously. Like a real proud homewrecker couple. Susan eventually, of course, got pregnant, and her and David got married on March 15th, 1991. Ooh. Sorry, guys, my throat was like itching. But let me jump back in. Let me stop being weird for a second. David was also having some family stress. 11 days before Susan and David's wedding, one of his brothers passed away from Crohn's disease, and it devastated his family. I'm not too familiar with Crohn's disease. I've heard about it, and I know it's pretty painful, so I know that was probably really heartbreaking for his family, and his brother was actually pretty... Did you guys just hear my phone go off? I went off through my computer and my phone. What the fuck? Oh, it's my mom. Okay, mom, you're going to have to hold on. But his brother was pretty young to pass away, so it devastated his family. David's dad even attempted suicide, but he survived, and David's mother actually took off to another city with another man. Susan and David's, so they, but regardless, they did still get married as sad as it was. And you can see where David, you know, they started their marriage off kind of rocky, like, because his brother had just died. Like, of course he was upset. Of course he's not going to be 100% himself. So Susan and David's first son was born on October 10th, 1991. They named the little boy Michael Daniel Smith. They both were really happy and loved him so much right away. Unfortunately, their relationship wasn't doing so good, and even having a baby wouldn't fix that. Of course, David's brother died, so that kind of played into it. They had some differences, and they just weren't making any, that was just not making things any easier for them. Susan was the type that she turned to her mom for financial and emotional help all the time, and David kind of hated that, how she ran to her mom for everything. Susan's mom influenced Susan on how to raise her kids, how to do what she's and what she was doing. Like, her mom always told her what to do. And so David hated that about her. So as you probably can see in the crystal ball in your head, the couple separated. So by March of 1992, they were officially separated, but still were kind of on and off for several months. Like, they weren't getting a divorce, but they were separated. They didn't live together anymore. Susan was dating another man at the time as well, but I can't remember who. I don't know. Did I get that name? I checked my notes. I don't think I wrote down. I don't remember even seeing his name. So I don't know. I know that she was having, another relationship. I think it may have been another coworker actually. But in November 1992, Susan the Wreck became pregnant again. Yeah, she became pregnant. She did say that it was David's baby, and that seemed to bring them back to one another again, in some fucked up way that they were. And they ended up buying a new home with some borrowed money, and they tried to live as normally as they could. But as you probably know, this doesn't end well. Susan's second pregnancy was pretty rough and hard on her, and she just wasn't enjoying it at all. David was unhappy in the marriage and ended up cheating on Susan in June of 1993 when she was a little over 5 months pregnant. They separated over this scandal that isn't scandalous but very predictable, but you probably already guessed it. They reunited once again when Susan gave birth to her second son. They named him Alexander Tyler on August 5th, 1993. But as annoying as it sounds, and I know you, it sounds annoying because I'm annoyed even saying this out loud right now, they split up again after only 3 weeks. David actually moved out of the house for good, and they decided it was done for good. Their relationship's over and done, over and out. But they literally broke up and got back together every other second, so who really fucking knows? I know people that commented on this case that were friends with them, they said that they couldn't keep track of when they were together and when they were not. So obviously they broke up a lot. But did you ever have that friend that would like, they would, I feel like it was the same situation. Like, they would do this with an ex and you're like, why are you doing this? But yeah, and you just like, you're trying to knock the sense into them and they kept going back and forth. Yeah, that just reminds me of the situation. So now that Susan and David are done, she's moving on to some other things in life. She quit her job and started a new job as a bookkeeper at Cosno Products, which was a pretty big corporation in South Carolina. She moved up the ladder fast, and she ended up as the executive assistant to the CEO of the company, J. Carey Finley. Now, here comes messy-ass Susan again, guys. This is kind of where her fucking downfall starts for real. Like, literally, this woman's choices make my fucking bladder hurt. Like, they're worse than mine, and that's saying something, because I've made some questionable choices in life. So with her new prestigious job, Susan had the opportunity to get closer to someone she had her eyes set on. That someone was the son of her boss, Tom Finley. Susan was very attracted to Tom and his extravagant lifestyle and just wanted to be a part of that whole hubbub of their life. Did I just make up that word? Yeah, hubbub. Susan the little, see you next Tuesday, got what she wanted, and her and Tom started dating in January of 1994. But guess what? Susan this woman gets back with who? David. Like, wow, what a huge shocker. I believe that David found out that she was seeing Tom and kind of was mad about it, and they ended up just ending their little affair, and she got back with David. But if I was either of them in that relationship, like, that relationship would look real never again-ish to me, so I don't know what the fuck they're thinking. Like, why can't they just go their separate ways and move the fuck on? Well, here comes even more predictable plot twist. Can you guys guess it? No? Do you want me to tell you? They break up again. Yeah. But hey, they lasted a few months this time, so that's something. Not to be too proud of, but still, we should give some acknowledgments to that. Susan told David this time that she wanted a divorce and took her nasty ass back to Tom Finley. Like, Susan, girl, quick question. What the fuck? Like, what are you doing? Now, I'm just going to put this out there that the actual relationship with Susan and Tom was very different in Susan's mind than what it was. Susan was, as you guys can tell, like, batshit crazy. Like, she was crazy. She was already planning out their future and scaring the hell out of this guy. Like, crazy Susan, chill out. But, like, she was playing, like, but while Susan was playing MASH, trying to figure out their wedding and how many kids they are and where they're going to live, Tom was trying to find out a way out of this crazy shit show of Susan's life because he was not having it. I think in Susan's head, she thought that, like, this guy would marry her and they'd be happily ever after, but that just was not going on in Tom's mind. So mid-October of 1994, Susan was a couple of days away from filing divorce papers when she received a letter from Tom. I believe that she sent a letter first because I think she finally was getting the vibes that, like, Tom wasn't, like, you know, he just wasn't interested anymore. His interest was dying down. And so I think she was kind of seeing that he didn't want kids or he didn't want to get married and stuff like that. So she wrote the letter first. This is one of those, the letter that he sent back to her was one of those Dear John letters. So I'm actually going to read it to you guys because it's not too long and it isn't graphic. Like the last episode of Mark LaTwit was in his graphic little confessions. But this is the Dear John letter that Tom wrote Susan. And he says, Dear Susan, I hope you don't mind, but I think clearer when I am typing. So this letter is being written on my computer. This is a difficult letter for me to write because I know how much you think of me. And I want you to know that I am flattered that you have such a high opinion of me. Susan, I value our friendship very much. You are one of the few people on this earth that I feel I can tell anything. You are intelligent, beautiful, sensitive, understanding, and possess many other wonderful qualities that I and many other men appreciate. You will, without a doubt, make some lucky man a great wife, but unfortunately, it won't be me. Shocker. Even though you think we have much in common, we are vastly different. We have been raised in two totally different environments and therefore think two totally different. That's not to say that I was raised better than you or vice versa. It just means that we come from two different backgrounds. When I started dating Laura, his ex, I knew our backgrounds were going to be a problem. Right before I graduated from Auburn University in 1990, I broke up with a girl, Allison, that I had been dating for over 2 years. I loved Allison very much and we were very compatible. Unfortunately, we wanted different things out of life. She wanted to get married and have children before the age of 28, and I did not. This conflict spurred our breakup, but we have remained friends through the years. After Allison, I was very hurt. I decided not to fall for anyone again until I was ready to make a long commitment. For my first 2 years in union, I dated very little. In fact, I can count the number of dates I had on one hand. But then Laura came along. We met at Cosno, and I fell for her like a ton of bricks. Things were great at first and remained good for a long time. That I knew deep in my heart that she was not the one for me. People tell me that when you find the person that you will want to spend the rest of your life with, you will know it. Well, even though I fell in love with Laura, I had my doubts about a long and lasting commitment, but I never said anything, and I eventually hurt her very, very deeply. I won't do that again. Susan, I could really fall for you. You have so many endearing qualities about you, and I think that you are a terrific person. But like I have told you before, there are some things about you that aren't suited for me, and yes, I am speaking about your children. I'm sure that your kids are good kids, but it really wouldn't matter how good they may be. The fact is, I just don't want children. These feelings may change one day, but I doubt it. With all the crazy, mixed-up things that take place in this world today, I just don't have the desire to bring another human life into it. And I don't want to be responsible for anyone else's children, either. But I'm very thankful that there are people like you who are not so selfish as I am and don't mind bearing the responsibility of children. If everyone thought the way that I do, our species would eventually become extinct. But our differences go far beyond the children issue. We are just two totally different people, and eventually those differences would cause us to break up because I know myself so well, I am sure of this. But don't be discouraged. There is someone out there for you. In fact, it's probably someone that you may not know at this time or that you may know, but would never expect. Either way, before you settle down with anyone again, there is something you need to do. Susan, because you got pregnant and married at such an early age, you missed out on so much of your youth. I mean, one minute you were a kid and the next minute you were having kids. Because I come from a place where everyone had the desire and the money to go to college, having the responsibility of children at such a young age is beyond my comprehension. Anyhow, my advice to you is to wait and be very choosy about your next relationship. I can see this may be a bit difficult for you because you are a bit boy crazy, but as the proverb states, good things come to those who wait. I am not saying you shouldn't go out and have a good time. In fact, I think you should do just that, have a good time and capture some of that youth that you missed out on. But just don't get seriously involved with anyone until you have done the things in life that you want to do first. Then the rest will fall in place. Susan, I am not mad at you about what happened this weekend. Actually, I am very thankful. As I told you, I was starting to let my heart warm up to the idea of us going out as more than just friends. But seeing you kiss another man put things back into perspective. I remembered how I hurt Laura, and I don't want to let that happen again. And therefore, I can't let myself get close to you. You will always be friends. We will always be friends, but our relationship will never go beyond that of friendship. And as for your relationship with B. Brown, of course you have to make your own decisions in life. But remember, you have to live with the consequences also. Everyone is held accountable for their actions, and I would hate for people to perceive you as an unreputable person. If you want to catch a nice guy like me one day, you have to act like a nice girl. And you know, nice girls don't sleep with married men. True dat. Besides, I want you to feel good about yourself, and I'm afraid that if you sleep with B. Brown or any other married men for that matter, you will lose your self-respect. I know I did when we were messing around earlier this year. So please think about your actions before you do anything you will regret. I care for you, but also care for Susan Brown, and I would hate to see anyone get hurt. Susan may say that she wouldn't care, copy intelligible, if her husband had an affair, but you know, you and I know that is not true. Anyhow, as I already told you, you are a very special person, and don't let anyone tell you or make you feel any different. I see so much potential in you, and only you can make that happen. Don't settle for mediocre in life, go for it all, and only settle for the best. I do. I haven't told you this, but I am extremely proud of you for going to school. I am a firm believer in higher education, and once you obtain a degree from college, there is nothing stopping you. And don't let these idiot boys from Union make you feel like you are not capable of or slow you down. After you graduate, you'll be able to go anywhere you want in this world. And if you ever wanted to get a good job in Charlotte, my father is the right person to know. He and Coney know everything who is anyone in the business world in Charlotte. And if I can ever help you with anything, don't hesitate to ask. Well, this letter must come to an end. It's 11:30 p.m. and I am getting very sleepy. But I wanted to write you this letter because you were the one who is always making the effort for me, and I wanted to return the friendship. I've appreciated it when you have dropped me little nice notes or cards or the present at Christmas, and it's about the time I start putting a little effort into our friendship. Which reminds me, I thought long and hard about getting you something for your birthday, but I decided not to because I wasn't sure what you might think. Now I am sorry. I didn't get you anything, so you can expect something from me at Christmas. But do not buy me anything for Christmas. All I want from you is this sweet, nice card. I'll cherish that more than any store or present. Again, you will always have my friendship, and your friendship is one that I will always look upon with sincere affection. Tom. P.S. It's late, so please don't count off spelling or grammar. So, if you guys are wondering about how he's talking about the married man she's sleeping with in the letter, it was one of her friends, another girl named Susan Brown. It was her husband. I don't think they slept together, but Tom saw her making out with him in a hot tub at a party at Tom's dad's house. I think that just added to the fact that this guy was just trying to get far away from the crazy. Like, Shrek swamp far, guys. Like, this guy was done with her shit. Now, I'm pretty sure Susan had to have had some clue of John's feelings before the letter because, one, in the letter she sent him, she said that she respected what he wanted. Two, he caught her making out with someone else, and, you know, that's not going to fly. And three, this guy is just, like, oozing the aura of, I don't want to fuck with you anymore. But Susan was living in Susan's fucking crazy wonderland and being delusional as hell, and she was hiding some crazy shit from him that would make things even worse. One, she was still having an affair with David and her stepfather, Bev Russell. So she was sleeping with two other men while she slept with Tom sometimes. Oh, and one more thing to add. She was also hooking up with her boss and Tom's father. But she was still holding out for Tom, though. Like, who knows why, but she is. Now, it's not 100% confirmed that she did sleep with Tom's father. I know when he was on the stand, he denied it in court. And who knows if she was lying about that, because she lies about literally everything. So who really knows? But Susan's craziness is now taking a turn for the worst. She was trying to do anything and everything to get Tom back into her grasp. In a last-ditch effort to get some attention from him and hoping that he'd have some sympathy for her, she decided to visit him and tell him about the sexual abuse and ongoing abuse of her stepfather, Bev. This didn't work out, and Tom didn't seem too sympathetic for her. I think it probably just made him super uncomfortable because, obviously, like, what do you even say to that? Of course he wasn't like, ew, get out. But he was probably like, oh my god, like, you need to talk to someone about this, and that's not me. So after that didn't work, she told him about her alleged affair with his dad. Now, this obviously got a response out of him, and it was not the response she was wanting. She told him that the details of the affair with his dad would probably come out in the divorce that she was going through with David, and she wanted him to know from her and no one else. I don't know why she thought this was going to go in her favor. Like, I think anyone in their right mind would think, wow, I should never fucking let him know that I slept with his dad. Like, or even just, like, leave it alone. Like, holy fuck. Like, this guy does not need to know that. It probably traumatized him for life. Like, this obviously disgusted Tom. And in shock, he told her that they would never have any sort of sexual relationship again and told her to get out. So any hope with Tom was really crushed and gone for Susan at that point. Like, she fucked up. So let's get into the most important day of the case. And that was on October 25th, 1994. This was right after her confrontation with Tom, and she was being and feeling like a psycho that day. She couldn't stand the fact that she would never be with Tom again. At work, she was so upset that she asked her boss if she could leave early. Of course, her boss looked at her and saw her in distress and said, okay, go ahead and leave. She stopped by the daycare to pick up her sons and in the parking lot stopped and talked to a friend. She told the friend about her troubles with Tom, the alleged affair with his dad, and the fact that Tom didn't want kids. She asked the friend to watch the kids so she could go try and talk to Tom one more time and tell him that what she said was a lie. According to the friend who watched the kids, Tom was not having it and got her out of his office, like, almost immediately. I believe this friend was Susan Brown, she was making out with this woman's husband in the hot tub. So later in the evening on the same day, Susan grabbed her sons and decided to go on a drive with them. This is according to Susan on what happened, guys. According to Susan, she was stopped at a red light at Monarch Mills when a black man with a gun jumped in her car and told her to start driving. With the gun pointed at her. Sorry, I just burped, guys. Susan did as he said, and they started driving. He then stopped the car and told her to get out, saying he wouldn't hurt her kids. Susan said he got into the driver's seat and drove off with the boys still in the car. Susan ran to somebody's home nearby immediately and started frantically knocking on the door and screaming, help me, help me. I believe the owners of the house were named Shirley and Rick McLeod, and they were actually in their living room watching TV and reading newspapers, and they thought it was weird because it was kind of late at night and no one really comes to their house and knocks on the door at that time of night anyway. So they called the police and the hunt for this man and the kids began. So all of, like, her loved ones, like David, her parents, her friends, everything like that, were at the McLeod's house, and they were trying to figure out what was going on, and Susan was, like, hysterical, and, like, these poor old people were like, we're just trying to go to bed. So they ended up all migrating to Susan's mom's house. David did return to Susan's side as the search became national. Like, this search went from 0 to 100 very fucking fast. And it went that way because of the way Susan described everything. She said that a black man kidnapped her car and her kids. And of course, people were like, okay, what the fuck? Like, why would this guy do this? And, you know, back then, I'm sure the racism was high, just as high as it is now and forever. And so I'm sure people were like, oh my God, a black man. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just fucked up. It's just fucked up what she does. Like, this caused the community so much havoc. And she basically, like, I admire the way the police handled this situation. Like, you would think that they would be going after all these black men, frisking them, trying to figure out, but they didn't. And in my head, I think that even from the get-go, I think they had a clue that this bitch was lying. So I'm glad that they didn't take that step and, you know, criminalize these innocent black men, especially during that time where things could have gotten way worse. So the manhunt was big, and everyone in the United States knew about it. Even in, like, Europe and stuff, people knew about it. Like, this was, like, international now. So everyone crowded around them and gave them support. Oh my God, sorry guys. I gotta hit my jewel. That was good. So they started giving interviews to the police. When interviewed by the police, they both looked very distraught. They cried, begged, and pleaded for their baby boys on TV, like, three different times. People were, like, on this. Like, people everywhere were helping on them. They, like, they handed out thousands of flyers, posted them everywhere, were putting ribbons everywhere with all the boys' pictures on it. The police were working really hard to find the car and the kids. They actually thought they spotted Susan's car, I believe, and they pulled it over. I think her car was a red Mazda Prodigy. That's what it was. And they pulled it over, and it wasn't Susan's car. So let him go. But at this point, people were starting to suspect something was off about the story Susan told. I think the police kind of knew right away that something was off from her story. The description of the man she gave to the police and the sketch artist was really vague and generic. Like, it was like it could have been anyone in that town. And I think one of the things that the police sketchers look for, and like identifying a suspect and seeing if the person is lying, is how generic, how they describe the person. So obviously, the more detail and the more they get into it, they know that this person knows exactly what this looks at. But if this girl, Susan, was like, oh, he was a black man, he had a beanie on, and he had a plaid shirt, like, that's basically what she said. In interviews on TV, Susan was actually, she was using the word loved, as in past tense, instead of love, on TV and with the cops. So Susan's story quickly began to unravel. On the second day of the search, David and Susan took a lie detector test. David passed, like, with flying colors, but Susan's results were inconclusive. And throughout the investigation, she was actually polygraphed 9 times. All times, the results were the same, inconclusive. The police definitely suspected her, but the search went on because, you know, they needed to find the kids and they needed to find this car. They had no idea what was going on. Volunteers and police people searched everywhere. Her house, the woods, divers searched in the lake. They searched about 100 feet into the lake, and they found nothing. The biggest break for the police in this case was Susan's own lies. So Susan kind of lied, got caught in a lie, in a little detail in her story here. Susan told the police that she was stopped at a red light when the man came and put a gun to her and got in the car. The light that she was stopped at on Monarch Miles would always be green unless it was triggered by something coming from the cross street. So if, like, another car was coming from the side, then of course that light would turn red. But if there was no one around, that car was, that light was always green. So, Susan claimed that no cars or anyone was around her at the time. So the light would have been green, and she wouldn't have had any reason to stop the car. And when the police told her about, like, these inconsistencies in the story, she was like, did I say Monarch? I'm at the next street. And the police even actually called the FBI asked for advice on this case and asked what, like, they think she's lying. They were like, yeah, the FBI even told them that they believed that Susan would be, say, like, it was the wrong street and it was supposed to be another street. But, of course, the police checked that out too, and it was the same story. But the press started getting leaks on Susan. They started seeing that maybe she had something to do with it. They started taking notice in her odd behavior. She wasn't acting like a mother would if her children were missing at all. In interviews that Susan did, she would sob, like, quote, sob, but there was, like, no tears, and it was obviously fake. If she could muster up a tear, she would, like, turn her face so the cameras or whoever sitting next to her could see that she had a tear. Like, she was obviously fake about this. So on the ninth day of the search, Susan and David went on CBS for the last time. Susan spitted her bullshit, of course, about, oh, my babies, I need them to come home. And she also addressed the fact that they were aware that people were suspect to Susan. But they denied it up and down. And Susan said, how could I ever hurt my children? And blah, blah, blah. Those are my kids. That's evil. And David even voiced his opinion that he was fully supportive of his wife. And, like, he didn't believe that Susan could have anything to do with the disappearance. But on the same day of that interview, November 3rd, 1994, Susan would be interrogated for the last time. Of course, they interrogated her relentlessly during those 9 days. So, you know, she had to have been coming unraveling down. The one person that did crack Susan was Detective Logan. He showed her compassion. He showed, like, a compassionate side to Susan and wasn't, like, directly accusing her and, you know, was being friendly to her with that southern charm that he had. He was playing into her ego, like, knowing he'd have to, like, sympathize with her to get any sort of truth out of her. And I think the other cops were kind of like, we know you had something to do with this, tell us, like, you know, pressuring her, and she wasn't responding to that at all. She was interrogated relentlessly by the police, but, like, this time when Detective Logan was interrogating her, she finally told the truth of what happened that night. So I think he was very direct with her to get the confession. He told her all of the evidence they had against her, told her what they knew, that she had something to do with the kid's disappearance, and he kind of just urged her to speak the truth. You know, they told her once again about the streetlight, just proving that she was lying. I think with all this thrown at her, Susan probably just had enough of her own lies at this point, and she asked the detective that was interrogating her to pray with her because she knew he was, like, a godly man. And she was pretending or what, but as they were praying, she started crying and she was confessing that she was ashamed of what she had done. Okay. So I don't know if we should stop here because the shit show just starts all fucking over again with this next part, all the details that are coming out. Maybe I'll tell you guys what really happened before we go. So, okay, just be prepared. Trigger warning, this is, like, really fucked up. And if you don't want to hear about child death, just stop listening at this part and come back next week. But I'm going to tell you how this whole happened. And it's really sad and fucked up, guys. I'm sorry. So, the police knew that obviously she had something to do with the disappearance, but they just didn't know what. So this is what really happened. When Susan put her two boys in the car that night, she was feeling suicidal. She was going to go to her mother's house, but decided against that. Instead, she took the boys to John D. Long Lake. She was going to kill herself and her children, believing that her children couldn't survive without a mother and that they'd be better off dead with her. So she drove onto the ramp, put the car in drive, and released the brake. But changing her mind, she stopped the car, got out of the car, and then put the car in drive. And as it was rolling into the lake, and watched as her two boys and her car disappeared into the water slowly. So obviously the police knew that at this time they knew something was going on, but they had no clue how horrible and evil, like, what she really did. Like, I think it shocked them to hear about what she did. Before leaking the news to the press, they needed to find the poor boys' bodies and the car. And you can probably remember the lake already being searched, but again, remember, they only searched 100 feet. So they actually didn't find the boy and the car because they didn't think of them being that far into the lake. But after the confession Susan gave, they knew the car was farther than they searched. So they actually got professional divers to go out there and go into the lake. I believe they found the car, I think it was 18 feet into the lake. It was found upside down. And here's another trigger warning. Just be prepared for this. They found the two little boys dangling from their car seats. There was a tiny hand pressed against the window from one of the boys that one of the divers found. The diver said as they came up, like, witnesses said that they were just in tears after coming up and telling them what they had found. They also found the letter that Tom Finley had written Susan in the car. I don't know if it was completely ruined because they got most of it out, as we already know because I read it to you, but they did find that letter. And this letter is like a huge aspect to this case. I think the worst part about this whole case is that Susan did this while the boys were sleeping. Like, they had no chance to plead, to escape, to scream, anything. And the autopsy of the two little babies proved that they were still alive when they were submerged underwater. Like, I can't even imagine the horror. This woman is just pure evil. Like, I can't even. Ugh. All right. Well, we're going to stop there for today. And we'll get into the trial and everything like that and the family's reactions and everything that comes after this in the next episode. I do think I'm going to post the next episode within the next couple days, just so you guys don't have to wait a full week for part two. But yeah, so I hope everyone has a good night. If you want to follow us on Instagram, you can do that at unwholesomepod, not podcast, just pod. You can find us on Facebook at unwholesomecontent. You can also email us. Our email is on our Instagram. You can just go ahead and click email. I'd love to hear you guys' thoughts about the case, and if you guys have anything else to add as well, if I missed something, if I got something wrong, I'd love to hear about that. I know citing sources is really important. So the next episode, after everything's done, I like to take that time and cite everything that I used. So I hope you guys have a good day and thanks for listening. Ciao.